kidding you that I'm very pleased to have you back again. And I'm about to make an admission, which I hope you will not regard as a confession. It is only an admission that I actually missed this shear. And when Wednesday night came along, inevitably I thought about the shear, and inevitably my wife spoke about the shear. I thought about it, but didn't speak about it. And silence is part of the subject of the shear tonight. Now, I'm very pleased to have you all back again, and it's a question of picking up the threads where you left them. It's always difficult when one has been away for some considerable time to pick up the threads, and I'm sure some of you have had that experience. You stayed away from the shiur for several weeks and you know how difficult it has been to get back into it. Well, here we have got it on two sides. I have been away for several weeks, so I'm going to find it difficult to get into it again. And you have been away from it for several weeks, and you are going to find it difficult to get into it again. At least on the plus side, we have had one another's acquaintanceship. There has already been brought about an accord between you on the one hand and myself on the other. And all this makes it considerably easier. Now, we are on to the subject of the Book of Esther. And, of course, our method has been, throughout our study, not merely to translate, not even to interpret, but really to, through the Nach, through Nevi'im and Kesuvim and the Torah, to be able to penetrate into those depths of Torah and to acquire an understanding of what a life of Torah really means. And I believe that we have been successful as far as that is concerned. I do think that we have gone a little bit beyond that. Just a little. And that is that something of the Torah that we have learned, we have begun in a small measure to apply to life. We have applied it with regard to the understanding of life, and we have also applied it with regard to living a life of Torah. It's merely the beginning of it, but at least there is something to it. And if one really wishes to understand Nach, one must have an appreciation of what Torah life is. And the Nach helps us to give us an appreciation of it, and an appreciation of what Torah really means, and what a life of Torah means, helps us further to understand the Torah. And there are so many things that are hidden from us in the Torah, and we are dealing with a little bit of that tonight. And I'm doing it in order to get back into our stride. We are on chapter 2. Nach is Nevi'im Kesuvim. Have you heard of Tanach?
Yes.
Yes. Tanach is two of the three parts. Tanach stands for Torah, Nevi'im, Kesuvim. Ta for Torah, Nach for Nevi'im, Ch for Kesuvim. That's Tanach.
I thought it was a new word.
It's not.
I'm going to get constipated. I didn't want to use
that. For the benefit of the new ones that are here, I should just point out that we use certain terminology, and those who have been with me a longer time understand the terminology that we use. And if you would just bear it in mind, for example, we spoke last Shabbos morning about the difference between an angel and a malach. although Malach is translated as angel, but an angel isn't a Malach and a Malach isn't an angel. We speak about a book and about a sefer. But a sefer is not a book. And unless one appreciates the difference in these words, one doesn't ever come to grips with the subject. For example, Portnoy's complaint is a book. It can never possibly become a sefer. It's not even allowed, you're not even allowed to put a sefer on Portnoy's complaint, because the sefer becomes contaminated. You understand? So there's a difference between it, and we must be careful not to confuse these words. And in the same way, when one speaks about characters in the Torah, the mistake that the secular world makes is that it wants to reduce every character in the Torah and cut it down to its own size. That is the mistake the secular world makes. It makes of Moshe an ordinary human being like any one of us. Cuts him down to size because the world is in a state today that it cannot elevate itself. It cannot raise itself. Cannot. And there are two ways in dealing with the world. And it's only one of these two ways that one can adopt. Either one elevates oneself, or one degrades oneself. If one elevates oneself, it is because we see an elevated world and we wish to raise ourselves to the elevation. We might not succeed. We might succeed only in part. But at least what is important is that man's life is an act of elevation. Or one sees just the lowest that is in the world, in oneself, and one wants to bring everything down to that level. That there is nothing in between. Man is described in the Torah as a Olef. He is ascribed to one who walks, who progresses, who advances. And if he is not true to what to that description, then he retrogresses. And it's important that we try to be faithful to this. That in our study of the Torah, when we have dealt with the great characters in the Torah, even when we have dealt with Achav, this man that wrought so much wickedness, we have been very careful also to see the greatness in Achav, as we discussed last Shabbos morning. The man with the blood pouring down, filling the bowl of the chariot, facing the enemy, knowing that he dare not flee, doesn't think of himself. We've discussed this. And now we are discussing people like Mordechai and like Esther. And if we are going to reduce them and cut them down to our size, and the size is our own size, we will never understand them, and we will never really learn anything. We are turning a sefer into a book, and we've missed the point. Whereas if we preserve the sefer as a sefer, and we can see Mordechai and Esther as they really are, and there is some attempt to understand them on their rights, it's inevitable but that through them we raise ourselves also. Now, we'll find in the second chapter, starting from verse 8 in the second chapter, Vayehi, Vayehi shomar devar ha-melech bedoso, when the word of the king was heard and his commandment, Uvehi koveitz ne'oros rabos el shushanai viro el yad haigoi, and with the gathering of these many maidens to Shushan, the capital, under the jurisdiction of Haggai, who was the man who was put in charge of all this, Vati lokach Esther el Beis HaMelech, that Esther was taken into the house of the king. It is most significant that the passive is used. It doesn't say by Ikhu Esther El Beis HaMelech or by Holcho Esther, chapter 2, verse 8. Got it? Well, all right. It doesn't say Esther went, but it says, and Esther was taken to the palace to Haggai, the king, to Haggai, who was put in charge of these women. And that is the first thing we must realize. Esther didn't go willingly. All the others went willingly. All the others went with a whole desire to be the chosen girl for the king's wife, to become the queen. Esther was taken perforce. Couldn't help herself. She was taken to the palace. Batitav ha-na'arova einov, batisor chesed lefonov. And then he tells us that she, this maiden, found grace in his sight. And she arose a feeling of consideration before him. And he was in a hurry to provide her with her needs, with the fragrances, and with her portions, which were given. A portion was given to each girl, each maiden. And he gave her seven maidens who were to minister to her needs. And he gave her the most suitable ones, Mibes HaMelech, that were to be found in the palace. Vayeshaneho ve'esna roseho letov beis hanoshim. And there he placed her and the maidens in the best part of the king's palace. And now comes the words that already concern us. Lo yigido Esther es amo ve'es moladeto. Esther did not reveal her people nor the place of her birth, because Mordechai had commanded her that she was not to say anything. And there is endless controversy and endless commentaries and interpretations of what is the reason that she was not permitted to say who she was. We have a repetition of that a little bit later, and I hope that I'll be able to get as far as that, because I'll need it in order to explain. She is not to tell who she is. It seems to have been quite important. After all, if the king is going to choose a wife, he wants to know something of who she is. Whenever I go in anywhere, I've got to fill out forms. I've got to fill out the country of my birth. They say the state, and I say, my country, the on state, their provinces, with these, put down the province. Then they want to know the town where I was born. What difference does it make to them? I open a banking account. What difference does it make to them? What town I'm born in? What is my citizenship? All right, tell them what your citizenship is. The only thing in the whole questionnaire that makes any sense is, well, what was the maiden name of my mother? That's the only thing that makes sense. They explain to me why they ask me that question. But what they've got to know, all the other things, my father's name, my mother's name, where my father was born. I don't even know the town where he was born. I have to know it, but it's only by chance. All these things, they want to know all this information. These are the questions that they ask. She is told not to tell from where she comes. Why not? Now, I'm taking one line of thought. Everything is being done by Esther and by Mordechai that she shouldn't be taken. Every girl had to come. The girls ran for the opportunity, the beauty contest, the prize. For the beauty contest, Esther goes reluctantly. Who wants to go and be the queen of a goy? whatever she does is to be. Mordechai does whatever he can possibly do that it should be. There are several schools of thought as to why Mordechai says, don't tell her. The one school of thought is, we Jews are already in a precarious position. If they know that you are chosen and they know that you are Jewish, it's going to be a lot of trouble. First of all, those who are jealous of you, and they're going to be many, are going to seek their revenge on you by that you got the prize by making it known that you are Jewish and everything that goes with it. One school of thought. There is another school of thought, and both these reasons at this stage are correct reasons. And the other school of thought is, who is Esther and from whom is she descended? Esther and Mordechai are the same family. They are descended from the stem of Binyamin. Now, I don't like calling it a tribe, because in America, immediately I speak about a tribe, they think of the Red Indians. I'm sorry. They think of the American Indians. And that's not what a Shevet is. So I don't like calling it a tribe. It's immediately an association of ideas, and this is the idea that they have of the tribes. Don't like speaking of them as tribes. Let us call them stems. So, Mordechai and Esther belong to Binyamin. Shaul, the first king, belonged to the stem of Binyamin. Mordechai and Esther are the aristocracy of the Jewish people. But they are more than that. They are the royalty of the Jewish people. He knows, Ahasuerus knows, that she is, from where she is, Moladet Tov, that from where she descends, from where she stems, that's just right for him. That means it's royalty. It's royalty. What was her name, Wallace?
Simpson.
It's not Wallace Simpson. This is royalty, and this will be in her favor, and it won't be against her. Now that is what Mordechai tells her, and he says, don't reveal your birth, and don't reveal your birthday, don't tell anything like that. I want to take this a little bit further, without going into any of the details here. So he tells us in verse 10, Lo yigidu Esther esamove et moladeto, ki Mordechai tzivo oleo shelo sagit, because Mordechai had commanded her, don't you speak about it. And every day Mordechai went in front of the palace to know, to assure himself of the welfare of Esther and what was being done to her. And then let us go on to verse 15. I'll come back, I'll do all these verses, but I want to get the subject of tonight's shiur. In verse 15, Uvahadia Tore Esther Vas Avichayel told Mordechai, and when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Avichayel, told Mordechai, the uncle of Mordechai, Asher Lokach Lo Levas Lobel El HaMelech, whom he had taken to be as a daughter, when it came her turn to go before the king, Lo Bichor Dover, she didn't ask for anything, Im Es Asher Yomar HaGai Svisa Merech Shemera Noshim. She didn't want any fragrances, and she didn't want any rouge, and she didn't want any lipstick, but he Esther Lo Seischein Beinei Kol Ha'er. And Esther gained favor, was looked upon with grace in the eyes of all who saw her. Again, Vatilo kach Esther el Hamelech Ahasuerus, and Esther was taken to the king. She didn't go willingly, she didn't go voluntarily. In the 10th month and so forth. Verse 17, and the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won favor and grace in his sight more than any other of the maidens. And he placed the crown of kingship on her head, and she reigned instead of Vashti. And now she has been chosen of the king. And then it says in verse 18 that the king made a great feast for all his ministers and for all his officers. It was the feast of Esther. It was in her honor. And Vanochel and Medina also, and he gave special, made special allowances for all his provinces, reduced taxes for that particular year. Prisoners were given an amnesty. And then in verse 19 and 20, and when the maidens collected a second time, Mordechai was sitting at the gate of the king. Ein Esther Magedis Muladatobe Esamo Kashir Tiboho Leo Mordechai. Again, Esther does not reveal her birth nor her people as Mordechai had commanded her. What is the second time? What is the second reason for the maidens gathering a second time? Now, in that, we've got a lot that is mentioned in the Gemara and in the Chazal. There was, when this had happened, that she was chosen, an unknown quantity. You can imagine what was the feeling of the ministers of the king, the officers of the king, the noblemen of the king, the aristocratic society that were always in the palace. They have daughters. This outsider comes in. You can imagine the feeling and the strong feeling that there was. And so he was prevailed upon that there should be a second chance given. And it isn't difficult for Ahasuerus to change his mind. We saw already what happened with Vashti. And that is the reason we kaved besule shenis a second time. And the second time there was, David says, Mordechai Yoshe Veshara Melech. Mordechai is there, he's very concerned with what is going to happen to her. He knows what happened to Vashti. She's already been crowned king. He's very concerned, he again sits there. And Ein Esther Margedis Moladato. What has been said about her to the king, she's an unknown, she's an outsider. You don't know anything about her. And now pressure is brought on her to say, who are you, from where are you? Ein Esther Margedis Moladato be Esamo. Esther does not reveal her birth, origin, nor her people, her birthplace, nor her people. Where she was born, who she is, she doesn't reveal. She's silent on that point. Here there is a very telling and beautiful chazal. She excels in a particular attribute, and that is an attribute of silence. Silence means not telling what you know. Keeping quiet about it. That is silence. And that is an attribute. From where does she get this attribute? Is it something that she has acquired herself? Is it something that she has seen somewhere? Or is it something that she has inherited? Those are the ways in which one can acquire an attribute. One can inherit it. One can be taught it. And with great discipline one can acquire it. And one can acquire it just by one's own intelligence, by one's own intellectual application, by one's own discipline, power of discipline, one can acquire. This is a question of science. Where does she get it from? She belongs to what stem? Who is the mother of Binyamin? Rachel. There you've got the science. When Rachel was supposed to marry Yaakov, and it's 7 years it went on, so she's been waiting for him for 7 years, and he's been waiting for her for 7 years. And what this marriage means to her. And at the last moment, she's ready, and she sees that her sister Leah is being fitted out with a veil. She asks her father, who is Leah marrying? She's marrying Yaakov. She said, what do you mean? He said, she's older, she comes first. Now we know that Yaakov saw the possibility of this. And he gave a sign to Rachel that when they are under the chuppah and she's heavily veiled, that she will give a sign, and by the sign he will know that she is Rachel and it's not Leah, because he suspected that. And when he made the arrangement with Yaakov, he said to Yaakov, I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, not Rachel, not Leah, but for Rachel, your daughter. I don't want you to take somebody else that's called Rachel and that's not your daughter. And Haketano, the younger one, I don't want you to give Leah another name. You give her another name. Now she's called Leah Rachel. And when she stands on the hook, he said, well, you said that it must be my daughter, it is my daughter. You said that her name must be Rachel, her name is Rachel. She's the younger daughter. So he ensures himself. And he still knows that he can be deceived in this. They arrange for a sign. What does Rachel do? Rachel hands the sign over to her sister. She is silent on it. And you know the story, Yaakov then marries Leah, and he serves, then afterwards he marries Rachel. Rachel didn't know that he would still want her after that. But he wants her after that, and he doesn't have to wait 7 years for her. He marries her 7 days after the wedding, and then he serves another 7 years, he serves for Rachel. So he serves in retrospect. The first 7 years he served in prospect, the next 7 years he serves in retrospect. So he served 14 years altogether. And that is the way it worked out. Rachel is the first one that was signed. Now comes another midrash. You will remember that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, wore a breastplate. Do you, on the breastplate, do you know what there was? Yes, very good indeed. There were stones. And each stone was a precious stone. One tribe had a diamond, and one tribe had a ruby, and another tribe had an emerald. I run out of the names of these stones. But each one had a precious stone. The name of the stone of the stem of Binyamin, the shavet of Binyamin, was Yoshpo, Yeshpe, the man who has a mouth and didn't use it. Where didn't he use it? He knew that his brothers sold Joseph. Never mentioned it to his father. The brothers kept it a secret because they were involved. He knew about it, he never mentioned it. The man who kept silent. It's inherited. It's inherited. Take another case. Yosef. Yosef undertakes to his brethren, they say, we'll save you, but on one condition, that you never get in touch with your father. It's a question of saving his life. So he's placed under an oath that he will never get in touch with his father. So they're not fools, they wouldn't save his life otherwise. eventually his father comes to Egypt. Don't you think that his father would be very interested to know, Joseph, what's all this about? You went away to inquire of the welfare of your brethren to bring them some fruit. I sent you on your way, and that was the last I saw of you. How did you come to be in Egypt? I was presented with a coat that I gave you as a gift, and it was in blood. Was it your blood or wasn't it your blood? I was certain that a wild animal had devoured you. That is what I was led to believe. I haven't heard from you all this time. Please tell me, how did you come to Egypt? We have no record of that at all. But what the Midrash tells us is that Joseph made it his business never to be alone with his father. He was only with his father in the presence of at least one of the brothers. He knew that his father went asking the question in the presence of the brothers. He knew that they were involved with this. So he saw to it that all the time his father was there, he was never alone with his brothers. He covered up that which he knew. Didn't tell his father. Can you imagine? His father might have suspected. There is a very great difference between suspecting and knowing. Can you imagine what it would have been like had his father known? What the relationship would have been between his father and his brothers? What the relationship would have been between his brothers and himself? Never a word to his father. Whose son was Yosef? Rachel's son. In both their sons, in Binyamin and in Yosef, we see the signs. Let us skip all that happens now and go down the line for several generations. We come to Shaul. Shaul belongs to the Shevet of Binyamin. He is a direct descendant of Rochel. Do you remember that story where Shaul's father loses the asses, and he goes to look for the asses, and he can't find the asses anywhere. And whilst they are looking, it's suggested that he goes to a chose, he goes to a seer, one of these men, righteous, pious, holy, God-fearing, heavenly oriented. Let's ask him. The man that they go to is Shmuel. And Shmuel knows that Shaul is going to come to him because Hashem has prepared him for it. Prepared it for it or for him already. And when he comes to him, and when Shaul comes to him, the first thing that Shmuel the prophet does is he takes a vial of oil, Vayikach Shmuel is Pach HaShemen, and Shmuel takes the vial of oil, Vayitzok al Rosho, Vayi Shokelu, and he anoints him and he kisses him. Vayomer Halok Kimeshokhu HaShem HaNachal Oselenogi. God has anointed you to be a king over his people. And then he tells him, now you came about the asses, you go here, you'll find the asses. He tells him where you'll find the asses. It's a beautiful passage. He says, Belechtuch ha'yel me'imodi u'motzosu shnei anoshim im t'guras roche v'gubinyonum yitzelse v'omre lecho. That you will go and near the place where Rachel is buried. That's his ancestress. Near the place, that is where you will find the asses and you'll bring them back. So Shaul knows now that he's been chosen by God to be a king. He goes back by Yomer Dod, and he brings it back, and he comes and brings the asses back. So his uncle says to him and to the young man that was with him, where have you been? I've been waiting for you so long. And he said, we went to look at the asses, and we saw that there were no asses, we couldn't find them anywhere. Vanovo el Shmuel, and we came to Shmuel. And the father, the uncle of Shaul says to him, tell me now, what did Shmuel say to you? Shmuel must have said something. What did he say to you? Vayomer Shaul dado, it's true. Shaul says to his uncle, he told us that the asses are already found. That's all he said. And then it adds the word. Ve'estabara meluchon, lo higid lo, asher omar Shmuel. But the matter of the kingship, that he didn't tell him. That Shmuel had said that he will be king, that he didn't tell him. Doesn't tell him what he knows. The midat hashtika, the midas hashasiko, the attribute of silence. Shaul, from where did he get that? Right back to Rochel. Now we've got Esther. Esther doesn't tell her origin. Keeps quiet. Great pressure is brought on the second time. Doesn't tell anything about her background and her origin. She keeps quiet. That same attribute goes right down the line. That same attribute. And you heard me speak on this subject. If a person has an attribute that he has acquired on his own, it's not that he's seen it practiced anywhere else. It is not that he has been taught it. Rochel, in the home in which she was brought up, she saw very little of this. In that home, she knew the meaning of shtiko, of keeping quiet, of not speaking, especially when a word can bring about disruption in relationships, whether it is family relationships or whether it is friendship. A word can bring about a disruption. She keeps quiet. Had she said, had she not kept quiet, then it meant that Leo would not have married. Can you imagine the disgrace that she would have suffered coming back from the chuppah, rejected? That she can't see, tells him. Binyamin keeps quiet. Yosef keeps quiet. Shaul doesn't say anything. Just, he must be over bubbling with the news. And if a person's got news, something that another person doesn't know, there's a terrific urge, there's a great danger for her to tell, to speak about it. I know this, I know something. Let the other person know. To be able to control oneself, and it doesn't go out. And now we see that Esther has got it. It comes right down the line. Nothing is ever lost. No sincere and true effort is ever lost. We cannot tell when it will reawaken itself. It may be in generations to come, but it will come up again. We can never tell. That is a midah which Esther has. Now, I wish to elaborate a little upon this. You can ask me a question, and you can say, where does it say in the Torah that you mustn't speak? What is wrong in this? It's the truth. What would have been wrong in Shaul having told his uncle, when his uncle asks him, what did Shmuel say to you? Can't imagine that a person can go to a man like Shmuel and all he speaks to him is about the donkeys. It's just, it's not possible. You go to a man like Shmuel, you don't come away with anything, you don't learn anything. So what did Shmuel tell you? What did he say to you? He said, the asses are already found. Doesn't say anything more about it. Where, and it's considered to be such a great thing. Where does it say in the Torah that one mustn't speak? It says in the Torah that one mustn't tell a lie. Umidvar sheker tircha. Right, so we know one mustn't tell a lie. It says in the Torah that Eltsua Shemra, giving a person a bad name by telling a lie about the person. This is a terrible thing. So we know that we mustn't give a person a bad name and tell a lie about him. We know Loshon Hara is forbidden. Even the truth about a person, we are not allowed to say it. If it is against the person, if it denigrates the person, don't say, even if it's the truth. We know that a person mustn't be a holy chrochim. We know that a person, if he hears something said about another person, even if it's the truth, mustn't go and tell another person about it. That we know. But it doesn't say that anywhere in the Torah that that which is true must also not be said. And here we come into a new area of the Torah. There are two areas of the Torah. There is the area of halacha, there is the area of law, of din. And then there is the area, the elevated area, the area of elevation. About which I'll say a few words after Anne has asked me what is running there. Mm-hmm. Anne, what's the trouble?
Oh, okay. It's just to your question, I want to add another question to the second part of that, when it bothers me, which is this attribute of silence. I could see a lot of negative components. I could see with Rachel, you know, how admirable that was. And I could see where you don't brag that you're going to be a king.
Yes.
But Benjamin, I feel like, you know, that could be questionable. He didn't tell this horrible deed. He could have maybe saved Yosef. He could have saved the father some grief. And the same with Esther, because it seems to me that, and we're often in this position as Jews, you know, today in contemporary society. When do you mention it? When don't you mention it?
Mm-hmm.
Should you mention it so that people realize, you know, you're Jewish and you're proud of it and you want them to know and don't let them be nice to you thinking you're not? You know,
absolutely,
or
correct.
Should you mention it, or should you not mention it because it's in poor taste, or I don't know, the question comes up.
There are certain criteria. The first one is, you don't speak about it if there's no reason to speak about it. You've cited cases where there's a reason to speak about it. The second thing, don't speak about it if it is in order to gain an advantage for yourself. You're going to boast about it, which you meant. Don't speak about it then. Don't speak about it if, by any remote chance, it can produce any harm. That is when you don't speak about it. If you can only produce good by speaking about it, then you do. If you want people to know that you are Jewish, so that you know what a Jew is, and you are Mekadesh Hashem, and you live up to the Torah, and he sees it, then you must do it. And I'm going to speak about that just now. Do you follow? Then you've got to speak.
Yeah, or someone makes a remark about Jews in front of you.
Yes.
And you don't know, well, on the one hand, you're putting them in an embarrassing position. On the other hand, you sort of feel this, I've felt sometimes, well, gee, don't I have an obligation to tell them that I'm Jewish and it's offensive to me? And to sort of teach them.
Yes, by all means. By all means, say it's Jewish and it's offensive to you. By all means. But if somebody is speaking about Jews and speaking very well about Jews and doesn't know you're Jewish, you don't have to tell him that you're Jewish.
Right.
Unless by your action you are going to enhance the value of the Jew. Now,
but isn't that Benjamin not telling about the...
Can you imagine what would have been if the... Benjamin went to his father and said, they sold Joseph as a slave. Can you imagine what would have gone on in that family? And how did it turn out to be? Is that the same fool? Can you imagine, just imagine what would have happened and compare what would have happened, compare it, what would have happened, compare with what did eventually happen. Look how it turned out. And how it would have turned out. There's a beautiful play by a man called Priestley, J.B. Priestley. Do they know about him here? No. J.B. Priestley. The play is called Dangerous Corner. Have you ever heard of that play? And it's a very clever play. And the play, the idea of the play is the very one that we have just spoken about this moment. What would have happened had Benjamin told his father, I want you to know about the truth, that is not, that's Joseph's coat, but that's not his blood. That is a Ted's blood. This is what happened there. This is what they did. What would have happened? It's called Dangerous Corner. And the play is about a family, all sitting, uncles and aunts and brothers and sisters and children, and all sitting in a lounge in a living room, and they're discussing things, and certain things, a certain subject starts coming up. I demand that we speak about it. And they can't help themselves, and well, the tragedy that comes out. All the tragedy that comes out. And in the last scene, the curtain comes up on the last scene, and you are back again at the first scene. Back again at the first scene. And it starts all over again. The last scene starts exactly as the first scene. And again, they come to a point, and one says, now, let us leave that alone. And the woman says, I think we should hear. And he says, my dear, will there come any good out of it? Or can they come back? And she says, who knows? You're right. I agree. Let us leave. And it goes on. They have a very nice evening together. So you are left with what could have happened. You've got a whole scene. Have they been so honest and they were so sincere and have aired it all and what could have happened? You've got to bear in mind what. How did he turn out in the end? Turned out beautifully. They all came together. Joseph sees in this the hand of God. All this. So what did he do? Now that is the way it works. So there is in life, yes, Eva. No, I didn't. You heard that somewhere else. You didn't hear that from me. Yes, no, you didn't hear that from me. I mean, he couldn't honor his father because he wasn't able to. And after that he honored his father as much as he possibly could. Now, you didn't hear that from me. All right? What is it that the Torah expects of us? There are certain things which the Torah lays down as a minimum requirement. That is one area of the Torah. And then there is another area of the Torah. That is the human. That is the human. Then there is another area of the Torah. That area of the Torah is the divine. Now man, at one and the same time, was created out of the dust of the earth. And he was created an image of God. God breathed into him the breath of life. And he's got that which is godly in him. Man is, there is the element of the human, there is the area of the human, and the Torah prescribes it. And then there is the element, then there is the element of the divine. That we are expected to elevate ourselves to. That isn't a deal. That is which we call with mean Meshuggah Sadeh. This is above thee, beyond thee. Nevertheless, there is nothing that the Torah that is in the world of the Torah or that we won't find in the Torah. And if this, there is this world of Lichmin Meshuggah Sadeh, there is this area of the divine, which is also for the man, then there must be some indication of it in the Torah. Where is the indication of it in the Torah? Look at these laws that there are in the Torah. It says in the Torah, you must not take revenge and you must not bear a grudge against any Jew. Now you know what it means, not to take revenge and not to bear any grudge. There is a passage in the Mesillas Yeshurim about which you heard me speak. Moshe Chaim Lutzaken's work on behavior, on conduct. And I'm going to quote to you, I'm hardly paraphrasing, what I'm saying are his exact words. I'm translating, but I'm hardly paraphrasing. He says, what does it mean you mustn't take revenge and you mustn't bear a grudge? It means that somebody could have done you a favor, could have done you some good, and he withheld himself from it. Not only didn't he do you any good, but he actually harmed you. And now, he is in a position where you can help him. Then you must help him. Because if you don't help him, you're taking revenge. So you must help him. Not only must you help him, but whilst you are helping him, you mustn't think of the wrong that he did you, because that's bearing a grudge. That's losito. It is losito and losito. And losito in Hebrew means much more than a grudge. It's again one of these words. If you translate netiro, it's a grudge. But a grudge is not netiro. Netiro is not a grudge. And netiro means you harbor the thought. It's still with you. So you've got to be able to do him a good deed without even harboring the thought that he has done you even in your paying the good. Says the Mesillas Yeshurim, that is required of a Jew. Now says the Mesillas Yeshurim, are we angels or are we human beings? What is it that God requires of us? Is this possible for a human being, says the Mesillas Yeshurim? Is this possible? Then it adds, and you shall love your next one as yourself. And you shall are we angels or human beings? If the Torah was given for angels, is the Torah, we can understand it. But it's not, it's given for human beings. The conclusion that we must draw from this is the Mesillas Yeshurim, and this is the only conclusion, that this is what the Torah requires of us. It's true. It's for angels. You're quite right. But what is a human being? Excuse me, I just got to give a translation of the man that thou art mindful him, and the son of man that thou regardest him. What is a man? Those laws are not made for a man. Those laws are not made for a human. Yet thou hast made him but little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor. Same time. So what is man? He is The Hebrew trans the Hebrew is but hasreyu me atme Elohim. I would translate it, thou hast made him but little less than God himself. And thou hast crowned him with glory and with honor. That is the human being. So there is the divine in the human being. You are quite right. This law that you mustn't take revenge and you mustn't be begrudging, you mustn't harbor a thought against the man, and you must love him as you love yourself, is not for unity. It's for malachim, it's for angels. But there is the divine in you too. This is a law for the divine. For the divine in man. It's a question whether man can raise himself to it. Is a man going to pull down the whole world to his own level? Is he going to reduce everything that is spiritual in the world to cut it down to his own size? It's not for him. This is not for him. The man can elevate himself. If he can elevate the human in himself to the area of the divine, and if he can live there, for him, those are the rules of life. So even in the Torah, you've got this aspect of it. This is hanhogor. This is behavior. This is conduct. This is musaf. Of course one can get away with a tremendous amount. Of course there are things that are written in the Torah. And one can get away with it. But getting away with a minimum does not create character in the human being. That does not create character. That doesn't bring about anything of the, doesn't bring out anything of the divine in the human being. For that you need something else. For that you need an elevation into the area of the divine. The Maseilas Yeshurim says, God wouldn't have asked us of this, wouldn't have put it down in the Torah, hadn't it been possible for the human being to achieve. So it is possible for the human being to achieve. It's possible for the Jew to achieve. He doesn't say the human being. He says it's possible for the Jew to achieve. Why? Because we know that every Jew has got three attributes ingrained in him. It's a seed in him. It might be dormant. That seed might never, never start growing. But it's there in him. And the three qualities are, he's got a sense of shame, he's got a sense of compassion, and he is one who wishes to bestow acts of loving kindness upon his fellow man. Ashonim, Rachmonim, Gomechatorim. To the extent that the Gemara says that if one finds a Jew and there's one of these attributes is missing in him completely, to the extent that you say, well, it's not even dormant in him, there's nothing that can awaken anything of this in him, you have the right to suspect his origin. Whether he is really Jewish, whether somewhere along the line something has not gone wrong and he's not altogether Jewish. Pashonim, Rachmonim, Gomlei Chasodim. Sense of shame, sense of compassion, and the desire to bestow loving kindness. That is the characteristic of a Jew. Once a Jew has this characteristic, he's able to do it. You heard me mention last Shabbos afternoon the story of Rabbi Pinchas Ben Gurion, how the two men came and they put two bags of barley away with him. There's a law about that in the Torah. The law in the Torah is if a man puts away two bags of barley with me, I can keep it for 3 months. After 3 months, if it doesn't come, he gets it, then I sell the barley, I take the money and I put away the money and I keep the money. It's easier to keep money than it is to keep two bags of barley. Doesn't take away the same amount of space. Doesn't need the same looking after, the same caring. Is it going off? Is it rotting again? I don't have, And then I fulfilled my obligation. The two men come afterwards and they want to have that which they deposited. Here it is. This is what I've got. According to the law, to the deen, he can even buy the corn himself, the wheat himself, the barley himself, provided another party makes the assessment. Then he's got to get it assessed from outside. Assess it, he takes it, he puts away the money, and this money is kept for the owner. That is according to the deen. What does Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yoyah do? They don't come. He takes it and he rents some ground. So they think you've got to pay rent for it. He said, I can't give you anything. But when it, from the result, they said, all right, we'll charge you a little bit more. He said, all right, charge us more. Sows it, reaps it, stacks it, sells what he needs to sell in order to pay for the rental. Sells a little bit more because now he needs a larger amount of ground to sows it again, and does it for 7 years. And when they come back at the end of 7 years, they say, we left two bags of barley with you. Have you got it? They knew that if they didn't have the two bags of barley, they'd have the money. Then they'd have the money. He says, yes, of course. Just look at there. Those storehouses, they are stacked with barley. It all belongs to you. According to the deen, he doesn't have to do it. But according to the divine man, that's what's happening. That is raising oneself to the divine. It's another area of terror. But the terror expects that we struggle and we raise ourselves and we try and. But even the struggle itself, it doesn't matter if you don't get there. The struggle itself must produce results. Nothing ever goes lost. So you've made a little progress. When we went to South Africa, and the direction of South Africa, the route we took was towards the southeast. And if I walked 1 mile away from this apartment in the direction of southeast, straight in the line of South Africa, am I any nearer to South Africa? This doesn't matter. That mile doesn't make any difference. It's so far. Doesn't make any difference. That is in material matters. In spiritual matters, it's not. In spiritual matters, whatever progress I make, it covers the whole area of the soul. And the way it works is as follows. If I've got a whole area and I want to cover it with gold dust, which is reasonably valuable today, I put away 1 grain of gold dust on this table. The way it works spiritually is that if I get so far as 1 grain of Torah on a higher level, 1 grain in the world of the divine, it's not 1 grain, but it's 1 grain that covers the whole area of the table. You know what a difference it makes? The whole area, only 1 grain. It's a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a millimeter in height. That's what it covers. And that is what it produces. I just want to finish off this. And this is what it says when Micah says, it has been told you, O man, what is good and what the Lord doth require of you. And he says 3 things. And the first thing is, Asos Mishpot, do justice. That is the lowest area of war. That's what the Torah requires of you. Then it says, the Ahavas Chesed, loving kindness. There you're already in the area of the divine. And when you reach that area, your next stage is Basnea Leches Im Hashem Elokeinu. And then you actually walk with God and you live in the area of the divine. You can ask me, you can ask me, well, how is it possible? Really, in the world we live, we've got to go out in business. We've got to work. We come into contact with people. Sometimes we come into contact with the worst parts of the human being. And he shows himself in all his brutality, in his selfishness. Is it possible not to be contaminated? How does one live? There is the principle in Torah, which is known as the Dalet Amos Shel Halacha. The Dalet Amos Shel Halacha is the four L's of Halacha, the four cubit square of Halacha. That is, that every person can create for himself his own atmosphere which he breathes, his own environment in which he thrives. Each man is able to create that for himself. He can be an employee. He can be now treated by his employer. He can be humiliated by his employer. But he's got four L's of our world. But he's got these four L's and they do come back. I wish I had Heinrich Philip of Princess Sama. It's possible that it's here in part. Maybe here in part, I'm quite sure that he didn't have the whole of it. No. I'm afraid he hasn't got it here. Unfortunately, it's not here. Heiner was an apostate. He wrote a book, he wrote a poem which he called Princess Sabbath. And a poet is a person who is, at rare moments they are, sees the truth for what it is and is able to depict it, is able to put it down on canvas or on paper or in stone, but he's able to do it. But Heiner speaks about the truth. And he describes the truth the way he looks, his clothing. He's like a cur, he's like a dog, carrying his pack on his back, peddling his wares, going from door to door. This was written 130 years ago. Hunter. And he despises him. And then Heiner says, the self-same Jew, he follows him around. And it's Friday, and it's Friday night, and he takes a peep into his hovel, and the hovel is transformed into a palace, and the table, with its white tablecloth, with its sparkling glass, with its cutlery, everything shining, and there he sits at the head of the table. Is it the same man? He's a king and his wife is a queen, and the children around are princes and princesses. Those are the four things of our God. That is the man's home. Outside the home, what can you do? And this is the very man. This is his haven. It is to hear that he escapes, but when he escapes here, this is his reality. What takes place outside, that is it. This is the reality of it. This is the man himself. With all the dignity, with all the bearing. And that is what we are able to do. To know raise ourselves to the realm of the divine. These are the Dalit Amu Shel Anocha. These are the four elements of Anocha, which everyone creates for himself, and he carries it out with him wherever he goes. We've just come back from a long journey. Of course I missed you. But at least wherever we were, we were ourselves. From the physical to the spiritual. We broke our journey on the way down to South Africa and we spent one day on the European continent. And we slept there one night. And my wife and if we are going to be with them. We were at home. We were at home. When we travel, my wife goes with the family space. God bless for the wine, dollar counter, the ice box, everything goes together. Everything goes those of the Dalit of the Shalabhata, which every Jew is able to create for himself, and he creates it for himself as his own. And no one can ever take that away. But all those who want. In the camps, there were Jews who went to their death singing. I studied together with a young man. He was the son of a very great man. And he came to a certain passage in the Talmud. And there it spoke about dying on Kiddush Hashem. And it spoke there about the dignity which one must preserve in the face of one of those who persecute us, should that ever befall them. And he spoke to me and he told me what his father had said about it. And his father had explained to him what it means and what is required of a Jew. His father went to the gas chamber. I've got an account in a safer that I've just bought now when I was overseas. An account that is given by a survivor of how he went to the gas chamber. That same man, all that is. He went and he took his Dalit Amu Shel Anocha with him. Wherever he went, those four things of Anocha with him. Of course it's very interesting. Of course it's very interesting. But I would like you to know of a world that is real. This is a world that is real. The final test of experience. This is the final test of it all. If anyone who sees that man says, that is a creature of the Almighty. Can't be other. I see the divine in that. Then the person has achieved that. There is that very well known story that is carried in the Midrash. Some of you might have heard me quote it before. Rabbi Shimon ben Chota, who buys a donkey and he buys it from a Ishmaeli and he buys it from a Ishmaelite and takes it, and his students, his disciples stand around him and they are fondling the donkey and they are stroking it, and then they see in its halter, they see precious stone. And they show it to their teacher, to Rabbi Shimon ben Chota, and they say to him, Birkas Hashem Yita Ashir. This is the blessing of the Lord. Hashem wants you to be rich. What you can't only do with this money. What you can't only build with it. Yeshivas you can build with it. How many disciples you can have with all this. And Rabbi Shimon ben Chota answers, Hamor lo kachi, even tevo lo lochi. I bought a donkey, I didn't buy a precious stone. Shimon ben Shota takes the stone in his hand and he walks. He goes to the Ishmaeli, he goes to the Gentile from whom he is born, to the church. Can you imagine how his disciples feel about him? This is their teacher. How they see him now, in what light they see him now. A donkey I bought, but I didn't buy a precious stone. And deliberately he walks step by step back to the God, and he gives it into his hand. Doesn't say thank you. He says something much more than that. Baruch Hashem Elokei Shimon ben Shota. Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shimon ben Shota. He sees in this a divine manifestation, not a human manifestation. No reason for interpretation. Baruch Hashem Elokei Shimon ben Shota. This is a man who lives on the level of the divine, not on the level of the human. It's permitted to live on the level of the human. Permitted. You will not be punished for not living on the level of the divine. No punishment for it. For not living on the level of the human, there's a punishment for it. No punishment for not living on the level of the divine. Doesn't that make it even more desirable? Doesn't it make it more desirable? That is what we are able to do. Can you know my story about Mr. Jacobson? When he was sitting at our table in Johannesburg, and during the meal, I see Mr. Jacobson, who was a man in business. He dealt with furniture. He's looking at my books. And I get such satisfaction. Oh, the other business man. Look what Mr. Jacobson is interested in. He's looking at the title of the books. It's an ordinary plain business man. This is very nice. And we finish the meal and we bend. And my wife brings the tea and the cake onto the table. And we are sitting in the tea. And he says to me, whatever you do, don't ever sell that book.
No.
I said, Mr. Jacobson, why not? He said, I knew the man who made that bookcase. You will never get that workmanship again. So much love he put into his work. Everything in that bookcase is absolutely perfect. So much love he put into it. He said, I look at that bookcase and I can see the man. But Mr. Jacobson, I can understand you very, very deeply. I remember how proud I was when I once saw a Rembrandt. And I said to the owner of it, I said, you know, I would have said that that is a Rembrandt. And he said, it is a Rembrandt. I said, how did you know? Because the picture speaks. It tells you it's a Rembrandt. I said, Mr. Jacobson, I can understand you very well. But tell me, Mr. Jacobson, you look at that bookcase and you know who made it. Look at me, Mr. Jacobson. Do you see in me who created me? Do you see Hashem in me? Do you see the Creator in me? And Mr. Jacobson was embarrassed. I said, Mr. Jacobson, you don't have to be embarrassed. I have to be embarrassed. Not you. If we live a life of the divine, the test of it is that the only way it can be explained, there is the divine in man. He says, Baruch Hashem, the location of Bechor. Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shimon Bechor. That is the way we have got to understand the divine destiny. That is their world. That is their world. She doesn't want to go through all of this. He does the contest very well. He's a beauty contest very well. Where is Esther in this beauty contest? She is in her Dalet Amos of Aloha. She is in those four L's. She has created for herself, which Mordechai has been created for her together with her. That is where she is. But that is the way we see Esther. But that is the way we see Mordechai with everything that she is. She retains all her dignity, all her poise, without the view from where she came. It might make her really want to take her. And she leaves that alone. And the only time she does refuse it is when she's got to say it. Then it's necessary. Then she tells her Jesus. Thank you, ladies. That's as far as we can get.
Thank you.